Okay.
Which we do through programming, through training staff, through community education, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I also work on a hotline two nights a week, an eating disorders hotline or helpline for relief. They have a specific eating disorders component because we get so many phone calls for eating disorders, so I have that line two nights a week. Basically, all I do all day and all night almost is eating disorders. So, phone number of the hotline, I'll give you to it at the end also, but it's 718-431-9501, and you'll get either myself or the other person who works the helpline. Or you can also call me directly at work. I did leave my phone number inside the folder if you have any questions. Okay, the first... Sorry? 718-431-9501. I just want to qualify by saying that we have... Oh, there's no clock. We have about an hour to do an overview on eating disorders, which is really a very, very short period of time. I usually do the overview and qualify it then as well when I do a two-hour workshop. So a one-hour workshop is particularly little amount of time to be able to do this. And I try to just, you know, focus on certain basics to cover and leave you plenty of time for questions. But I find that people have lots and lots of questions at the end. Yes? Eating disorders has to do with people who have a difficult relationship with food. We'll discuss it. You'll see. Okay. Right. So what I'm going to try to do is cover the basics and then leave plenty of time for question and answers. But please know you're going to walk out of here with more questions than answers. Okay? Don't expect to walk out of here feeling like everything got covered. Okay, I'm just going to go quickly. What we're going to do is we're going to define the eating disorders, discuss the prevalence of it, the signs and the symptoms of eating disorders, what you need to look out for if you're concerned somebody has eating disorders, what you need to know, the contributing factors, okay, projected contributing factors to eating disorders, the effects on people who have eating disorders, psychological and physical effects, price that they pay for having the eating disorder, and also we can start talking about what we can do about it. Okay, as for eating disorders, there are three basic major eating disorders as of today defined. The first one is anorexia, also known as anorexia nervosa. The second is bulimia. The third is binge eating disorder. Okay, there is something, if you notice, I have a parenthesis right here. I don't know if you can read this. Can you read this?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. There is something called night eating syndrome, which is a new phenomenon that's coming up on the radar, but it's not really considered one of the three basic eating disorders, but it might be good to know about. Okay. Anorexia, I'm going to give you working definitions of anorexia. The clinical definition would be what the doctor would need to see in order to say that the kid can be covered by insurance because they technically have anorexia nervosa. We could discuss that a little bit, but as far as our purposes are concerned, I don't think I really am too concerned how clinically not well they are. Or we're much more concerned about... Sorry? We're much more concerned about what's happening functionally and how they're functioning physically and psychologically, regardless if it fits in specifically to a clinical disorder or not. The first one is anorexia. A working definition of anorexia, meaning not the clinical definition of anorexia, but the working definition of anorexia is somebody who refuses to eat or restricts the amount of food that they take in. In other words, it's less, they take in less food, and they struggle with taking in less food than their body needs in order to survive and in order to flourish. Bulimia, would be, again, a working definition would be people, someone who eats a lot of food at a small period of time. In other words, the same amount of food that somebody else would eat over a much longer period of time, they will eat in a very small period of time, and they will do something to compensate for that eating. They get concerned once it all goes in, and then they have to compensate for that. So that compensation could be through either purging, vomiting. Purging could be actually for all of them, but vomiting is as a form of purging. Enemas, diuretics, laxatives, obsessive exercise, fasting. These are all, as long as, if the dynamic in the head is that the person eats a whole bunch because they feel out of control, and then they have to compensate for it on some level or another, and they do, that's usually bulimia. Even sometimes people who take drugs in order to then stop eating, as long as the dynamic is in place, you take in, push out. Binge eating disorder is a more recently defined or recognized eating disorder, I'd say about 6 or 7 years. And that's basically bulimia without the compensatory behaviors. So that it's people who either eat without regard to hunger and satisfaction, eat on a continual basis, or eat much larger amounts of food than other people would eat in the same period of time, but they don't engage in the compensatory behaviors. And night eating syndrome is, just to mention it, is people who get up in the middle of the night and they found, and then they eat, and lots of times it's unconscious, they're not aware that they're eating. They can even like break through locks and stuff like that, and that they put on cabinets. They wake up in the morning and they find that their face is full of food, that there's wrappers on the floor, et cetera, et cetera. It's like an unconscious eating that
has recently surfaced as a problem. Basically, as far as... But basically, the prevalence of eating disorders goes something like this. Anorexia, binge eating disorder is actually the highest prevalence. Then comes bulimia, and then comes anorexia. Okay, the other thing to know about eating disorders is that we definitely find them in males. At least more recently, we've been finding that more and more. There's a huge number of people that have eating disorders. Like 5% to 10% was like a statistic that like 10 years ago. And so now we have even greater numbers of people who are suffering from eating disorders. And we're certainly seeing more males suffering from eating disorders. All kinds. Although, let's say for bulimia, you might see them do more the over-exercising as opposed to the purging. It's just, the form might be slightly different, but the disorder is the same. Also, we're seeing them filter down to younger and younger ages. Okay, I've heard of 6-year-olds, 5-year-olds, vomiting, being afraid of getting fat, having that whole self-conscious thing, body image, obsession going on. So we know that it's filtering to lower and lower ages, which is dangerous and very important for us to be aware of. Another thing to know is that people very often will judge the severity of an eating disorder by the size or the weight of the person. This is a big mistake. Okay? There are lots of people who are anorexic that don't look anorexic. There are lots of people who are binge eaters, don't look like you would assume a binge eater would look, etc., etc. And it doesn't mean that they're not in danger of dying, and it doesn't mean that they're not suffering from an eating disorder. And that's very, very, very important to know. Okay? Okay. Let's go into the signs and symptoms. Oh, you know, one more thing. Let me just show you something here. All of these eating disorders are kind of overlapping. In other words, it's not like one ends exactly over here and then the next one begins. There's really a lot of overlap. Some people suffer from, you know, binge eating and anorexia, et cetera, et cetera. That would probably be bulimia, but there are definitely overlaps in the eating disorder. What's important also to know, and this is going to be more in terms of signs and symptoms. But the way I think of it is there's a spectrum, okay? Let's say we have healthy eating on this side, and we have eating disorders on this side, right? We have that spectrum. So if we were to look at, let's say, United States, probably only a small percentage of people would fit into this category where they have healthy, unobsessive, unselfconscious eating and body image. You know, no self-consciousness, very relaxed attitude toward food, want to give themselves a lot of nutrients, et cetera, et cetera, in a very unburdened way. That would be a very small percentage of Western society. A lot of Western society fits into this, which has been characterized as disordered eating. Okay? Which is not exactly an eating disorder, but it's between healthy eating and eating disorder. That's where lots and lots of people fit in. And then you'll have eating disorders. Okay? What's important to realize is that people who are healthy, let's say, the more they are healthy eaters, have healthy attitudes toward their body, self-esteem, et cetera, et cetera, generally what you'll see is they have a variety of interests. They enjoy life. They do lots of different things. They like to horseback ride, to write, whatever it is. They have a variety of interests focused in many different areas. The closer somebody gets to an eating disorder, the smaller their focus becomes. So that it becomes an obsession. So that at the end, when they're suffering from an eating disorder, this is all they can see. There's nothing else that matters. They'll sleep through the days that they don't eat. They won't go to parties because they're afraid of the food, et cetera, et cetera. Everything is focused around the eating disorder. So I don't want to wait until someone gets to here, but I just want to be aware that it goes, you know, along some sort of spectrum. That's how it works for most people. Lots of people falling somewhere in here. By the way, if you have a question, you're welcome to raise your hand to ask me, but if it's something that we're going to cover, I'm just going to say that we will cover it, and if not, I'll be happy to answer. Yes?
That's what I wanted to talk about. Great.
Thank you. Okay, eating disorders have three components. An emotional component, an attitudinal component, and a behavioral component. Yes?
I think a lot of people eat often to feed themselves because I think they're under a lot of stress from what happens. They're looking to feed themselves, and when they're bored, they're in love, so they're looking for something they have to think.
So we have an emotional component, an attitudinal component, and a behavioral component. We can't just look at the behavioral component, okay? You won't generally have somebody starving themselves unless there's a psychological and emotional component. But there are some people who just enjoy eating, okay? So, or whatever. There's many different combinations of the way they can relate to food. But if it only comes out in the behaviors, and they are confident in their self-esteem, and they have a positive body image, and they have a happy attitude toward life, that is not an eating disorder. Not usually an eating disorder. People do get concerned because they get concerned for health reasons, et cetera, et cetera. Sometimes it might be some kind of denial. You want to look at the whole picture. But there are people who are actually don't care if they eat, they know they're not a size 2, and that's okay, that's not an eating disorder. Does that answer your question? Okay. So all three components have to be in place, and also when you're looking for signs and symptoms, you do want to sort of do a little observation and see if a couple puzzle pieces fit together. Okay, not just taking one puzzle piece, although that's not necessarily, depending on how dangerous that one puzzle piece is, you know, you may want to look into it anyway. Physical symptoms of anorexia. We're going to do anorexia first. The trouble with all of these eating disorders is a little tricky because the beginning stages are the hardest stages to detect. And that's really when you want to get in there.
and try to help them. But maybe. Maybe.
Some of us tend to jump the other way and think, oh my God, you're just looking at every person they see. Yeah.
Isn't it true that a person is only going to be open to help if they themselves are at a place where they're respected? And if someone's like on that track, you know, and how much you guys are going to just mean, if they want to go there, it's like they're talking to them. Every situation is different, and it depends. Sometimes people are younger than they can be comfortable after that. But even after observation, then you get to see an individual's children with it. But sometimes they're not. Sometimes they get to help the patient, and then the kind of intervention you have that they receive. Often there's a way to talk to them, there's a way to speak to them, and if everything else is staying the same in their lives, in other words, still all this chaos going on in their family, et cetera, but only people that want to change the eating disorder, then yes, you're probably right. Then you're going to continue to need that hope. But if people take it as a symbol or a signal that they have to change, and something has to change in the environment, then other things can also fall into place, and then there can be more motivation to change. It really depends on every situation. Some situations are just a short trip. There's nothing you can do. You take them some water, they won't drink, and there's nothing you can do. You know? But I think there's more than we necessarily think is possible. Okay, anorexia. Physical symptoms of anorexia. Sometimes, not always, obviously, a rapid weight loss. Okay, thinning hair, more of a thin skin, fainting, or weakness, constantly being cold, wearing lots of layers, and you'll find that they're often cold constantly in places where nobody else is cold, because they just don't have any calories inside of them, giving them food. Some anorexics, I don't know why this is a famous symptom, but some anorexics will have like a little bit of like yellowish hands. I know, but it's not, believe me, there are plenty that don't have that, so I get nervous saying that as a sign and symptom because I don't want people to look at the hand and say they're, right, exactly. Exactly. If they're not obsessed with carrots or oranges or something like that, they won't get this. There are some anorexics who all they eat is chocolate chip cookies. Like, this is their safe food. Understand, everything else is off limits. That's still anorexia. You're still petrified to eat everything else. For bulimia, what you will see sometimes is something called the chipmunk look. It's a swelling of glands right along the neck, and that comes from bulimics who purge, who vomit. Because what happens is that the salivary glands start to absorb the nutrients over here, since after a while the body learns that the food that goes down comes back up again, and it's not going to get the nutrients. Like in a survival attempt, the salivary glands will try to absorb the nutrients from here. So you might see some swelling here. I'm sorry, just one second, and then I'll... you might see bloodshot eyes. That comes from the pressure of throwing up. Brown teeth. Like, people with discolored teeth, yeah, that's something, especially when you see, sometimes it's drinking coffee, but sometimes these people drink so much coffee that that's also a sign of their eating disorder, because they skip the food and they drink the coffee. But discoloration of teeth very often can be a sign of, if that's from the acid, from the purging, that comes up and marks the teeth. Sometimes you'll see scarring. Minimal. It's not something so obvious, but there'll be a little bit of scarring, like right here on top of the knuckles, because that's from if they're purging, if they're vomiting, the roof of the mouth hitting the top of their hands. So that this way, that could be also a sign in the system. If you see enema packages lying around, obviously, if you see laxative packages lying around, somebody who's constantly going into the bathroom during and after meals, that would also be a symptom of perhaps, definitely something that you should look into and be concerned about. Yes? What symptoms does a person get when he becomes anorexic?
So each situation is different, and then I would need to speak to you personally about that particular situation. Okay, binge eating disorder. Binge eating disorder, like we talked about before, some people just like to eat. I think that the attitudes might manifest a little bit more clearly for people with binge eating disorders in terms of the emotional attitudes. You might hear them putting themselves down and eating lots and lots and lots. But the main thing is that they eat food. People who suffer from binge eating disorder either eat loads of food, either behind people's backs, not what people can see. I've read stories of like people going into the bathrooms and eating in the stalls so that people won't see them eating, or eating consistently throughout the day without regard to hunger and fullness. There's a lot of shame associated with all forms of disorders, particularly bulimia and binge eating disorder. But that's a huge component of it. There's a lot of guilt, there's a lot of shame, a feeling of being out of control, depression. Now the thing to know about binge eating disorder also is that, people also assume, like we said before, that people who have binge eating disorder are obese, and that is not an assumption, that's not a good assumption to make. I believe that there is a percentage of overlap of people with obesity who have binge eating disorder, but there are plenty of people with binge eating disorder who do not have that, do not have obesity, and vice versa, people who are obese who do not have binge eating disorder. Okay, somebody had a question?
The night eating fits right into the day because things that they're hiding.
Yeah, but it's unconscious. It's slightly different.
It's slightly different, but it does fit into that sort of mentality they're hiding. And subconsciously, they're waking up in the middle of the night. Everybody else is sleeping, they're not going to see them.
It could be. It could be. They don't know enough about it yet, but it could be. It's a possibility. Psychologically and behaviorally, what you might see in someone with an eating disorder is somebody who's constantly putting themselves down. Somebody who thinks that if only I lost weight, then I would. And if everything in their life sort of focuses around their struggle between being thin and that's it. Like, I would get dates. I would have friends. I would be popular. I would do well in school. A lot of their struggles are focused and hinged on the food. So you'll hear a lot of talking about that. You'll hear a lot of, not always, but if you do hear a lot of put downs. Oh, I'm so fat. Oh, this. Oh, that. I know it's in file to do that in America. So you have to make your distinctions, but take it together with the other symptomology and you can know if somebody is perhaps suffering from an eating disorder or at least a body image dysmorphia so that they should at least get some help. People who don't want to be in pictures because they say they're too fat, they like hide in the back. People who don't want to show up to parties because either they're afraid of food or they're embarrassed about being seen. What might be some other psychological things? You're going to get up there. Yes? Right. That's a physical symptom that can be... Right. So if people are eating or drinking things to avoid their appetite, to avoid feeling their appetite, like drinking lots of Diet Coke, drinking lots of coffee, drinking lots of water, they're restricting their intake and taking in calorie-free food for that, that would definitely be a form of restriction. Yeah.
A person with anorexia, when they get weight, like if they're in treatment, let's say, they drink a lot of water and they have more artificial weight.
Right.
So I'm a dietitian. I just interviewed at the Renfrew Center, and that's what they told me. That's one of the things that they do is artificial weight besides the clothing. Is
right.
Water.
Yeah. They're very, very sorry.
Diet Coke.
Yes.
It happens to be that my youngest is battling with the eating sort of thing, actually, because her sisters were on her head. Anything gay and can't be fat, you know, so I'm sure. But as much as I begged the doctor to address it, he wouldn't because she did not have the physical.
Right.
And she wasn't doing it. It just happened to be that her body was not responded in that direction, and the doctor refused to address it because her weight did not show it, and her skin did not show it, and her reflexes did not show it, and now she's over 20 and
right. Unfortunately, I mean, what you really need to know, and what's really important, is if you're concerned about somebody who has an eating disorder or a body image struggle, etc., you really need to get expert help, specialized expert help, because people go to doctors that think that they know what they're saying, and they honestly, they really don't. The same thing with therapists. There are therapists who treat people with eating disorders who have absolutely no specialty training. And then there are those who have specialty training who you don't, who are not necessarily very effective. So you really want to look into it. It's a significant issue. It makes a very big difference to the efficacy of the treatment. And you can waste a lot of years in the wrong kind of therapy if you don't do that kind of research.
Do you have recommendations?
I work on a health plan. I'll give recommendations.
Okay,
the other thing that I want you to know is diabetes. People who are diabetic, if they are suffering also from an eating disorder, firstly, it's extremely dangerous. A lot of times they'll play with their insulin so that their body consumes the calories and the food that it takes in. It's a very, very easy way for them to control their weight. Now, I never say this in front of students because I do not want to give anybody the idea. I'm saying this in front of parents and teachers, etc., but it's something that you need to be aware of. So if somebody's their blood tests or whatever their testing is in order to monitor the diabetes is being very erratic and nobody can figure out why, know that this is a possibility. It's extremely difficult to treat. It's a specialty onto its own. There are people that do treat it, but it's definitely something to be aware of. The other thing to be aware of is people who have attention deficit disorder and other such disorders where you're taking stimulants. A lot of people will take stimulants or even drugs in the service of an eating disorder because it minimizes appetite. So if you see that, or if this person is someone who suffers from ADD or is taking Ritalin or whatever, you also want to know that that could be an issue. Okay, let's talk a little bit about contributing factors.
I just wanted to mention also something else that they said, the Renfrew Center, a center where they treat eating disorders in Philadelphia, that it's very rare that they admit somebody that doesn't have an underlying psychiatric illness, whether it's depression, bipolar.
We're going to get to that.
Yeah.
We're going to get to that.
It's very rare that they don't. Like, most of the people they admit have another underlying psychiatric problem.
Okay. So as far as the contributing factors are concerned, these are somewhat controversial because nobody knows for sure. But I'll give you the basics in terms of what the research seems to indicate from what we know so far. So there's a genetic component. I'll correct that. There seems to be a genetic component that has not been proven yet. I'm a little hesitant about the whole genetic piece because I think what they're looking for on some level is a pill, you know, to just like take it away. And no matter how much they try, that's not going to happen, even if there is a genetic component. But there can be. It can run in families. There could be vulnerabilities, just like there could be a vulnerability to alcoholism, there could be a vulnerability to addictions. If somebody's under stress and their family has a lot of eating disorders, the vulnerability can be toward an eating disorder. That would probably be a genetic component. There are personality factors. Kids who are highly anxious, kids who are perfectionists, or obsessive compulsive sometimes. If you see a lot of anxiety, a lot of perfection, and like you said, perhaps depression, anxiety, it's hard to know what comes first, but if you're suffering from some kind of depression, that could be a psychological contributing factor toward eating disorders. So they find that there are certain personality types that generally tend to manifest in the eating disorder population. There's also interpersonal factors, how their family works, their family system, mostly the family system, somewhat the societal system, which is what we're going to get into soon. Actually, I shouldn't say that. As far as the family system is concerned, that is definitely a contributing factor. The nature of the relationships in the family, how much chaos there is in the family, is there physical abuse, is there sexual abuse, is there neglect? Okay. See, because eating disorders are not about food.
at all. I know people seem to think that they are, you know, oh, if only she would eat normal, then she didn't, and I eat this, and it nothing to do with it. I'll give you an example. Somebody who's suffering from neglect, and this is an oversimplification, but somebody who's suffering from neglect might be, and I'll choose a binge eater. And because what happens for the person, what's happening for them on a psychological level is that they're suffering on an oversimplified psychological level, that they're suffering from neglect. They feel a certain emptiness. That emptiness is not something they can tolerate because it just feels like neglect. It feels like an emptiness or a hunger, an openness they can't tolerate. So they need to constantly anesthetize it with food. Okay? So saying to them, just eat a normal diet, has nothing in the world to do with anything. Okay? It has much more to do with what's going on for them psychologically. Societally, you need to have a society that holds the certain attitudes in order to have eating disorders. Okay? Eating disorders don't happen in every society. Society is a large component of it. In other words, if you had the same people with the same vulnerabilities in a different society, it would most likely not manifest as an eating disorder. Okay? But in our society, where dieting is so commonplace, where dieting or whatever eating plans or whatever you want to call them are so commonplace, external restrictions to food are so commonplace, the belief that dieting is going to make somebody thinner is also part of the system. The reinforcement of the concept that being thin is extremely, extremely important. All those kind of societies are where you will see eating disorders. There was an experiment that was done, I think it was 3 or 4 years ago, on an island when they didn't have any TV, and they measured the prevalence of eating disorders, which is very, very, very little. And I think it was after 2 or 3 years, they had brought TV on investigation. So that when they are not around you, they will continue to do them. Because they have a desire to implement the lessons that you taught them, right? I have absolutely no idea what time it is. Okay. So you don't want to do something whereby they're only going to do it because you're there and you're sitting over their head and you told them that they have to do it. That's not going to create a positive relationship with the particular value that you're trying to reinforce. For example, Frumkite, right? There's 2 ways you could teach Frumkite. You could teach it on Shabbos, we don't this, and on Shabbos, we don't that, and we don't wear wooden linen and wool, and we have to shake a little and tukkus, and whatever, right? That's one way. You could do it that way. You'll create a sense of habit in the child, whatever relationship you'll create, but that's one way to do it. When the child gets old enough, either they will keep it or they won't keep it. We don't know, but certainly I know that it's not internalized in a positive way to the extent that I would feel comfortable that they want to do it on their own. The other way to do it is to teach them the beauty of Shabbos. Something that you want to create within them the desire. You want to create within them the desire to be from, the desire to grow in from Christ, the desire to keep Shabbos. You're empowering them to have a positive relationship with the lesson that you want to teach them, so that they're not just doing it in front of your face or because they feel under pressure, but you created within them an appreciation for the same value. Okay? So if you're working with kids, if you're trying to teach a kid about eating healthy, you're going to argue about, sorry, it's supper time, and you can't have your Laffy Taffy, but if it's going to constantly be a power struggle around food, the only thing that will happen is some sort of power struggle around food will be left over, and either the kid will go wherever he wants and eat behind your back. But what have you taught the kid ultimately? Except for some symbolic power struggle between the parents and the kid. And also, the kid learns not to listen to their internal signals, not to listen to their internal huggers, and to pay attention to them, right? So what you want to do when we often take the kids is, like if a kid says, you know, I'm really concerned, I eat too much or whatever, we will say to them, I'm a little concerned that you're not eating enough. And what we do is we flip it around. Because whenever you take away, just like we talked about before, whenever you take away, it creates a sense of deprivation and a desire to like hoard what it is that you feel deprived of. So I'm concerned you're not eating enough. Do you know that in the body needs vegetables, needs fruits, needs grains, needs protein, needs fat, needs salt? Did you know that? So what are you eating? I'm eating potato chips. But what happened to the chicken, and what happened to the eggs, and what happened to the broccoli, and what happened to the grains? In other words, what you're doing is you're empowering them to widen, not restrict, but widen their choices in an informed way, okay? So that they get the idea that what they want to most of the time do is give their body nourishing food, and every once in a while, you know, even if it's every day, but as long as the in general, over, let's say, the span of a couple of weeks, most of the food that they're taking in is giving their body nutrients, then you probably, you know, then you know you're teaching the kid that that's an okay way to go about it. I didn't say a thing about calories, okay? I didn't say a thing about that, but what I'm trying to do is empower them. It's much more empowering if you say to a kid, you know, okay, so cut out the potato chips, you know, and cut out the candy, or to say to them, make sure you're eating enough. I want to see, when you come in 3 days from now, I want to make sure that you're eating enough, you know, foods. And naturally, the other stuff will fall away. Not from a place of restriction, but from a place of teaching them how to take care of themselves. The same thing with exercise, the same thing with movement. If it's going to be, I have to go to the gym, you know, and if I don't, I'm going to blow up, that fear-induced, you know, gym stuff, that's not going to create a positive relationship with their body. It's not going to create a positive relationship with exercise, and you're not teaching anything. The only thing you're doing is forcing, right? But if we can, in the beginning, at least when they're young enough, have kids do activities that they love, because they love it. If the kid loves to dance, so they go to a dance class once a week. If the kid loves to bike, so they go biking. Not in a forceful, you know, every week you have to be biking this amount of time, but it just naturally, you create a positive relationship for them with movement, it will become integrated. And as they get older, they learn, you know, it's really good to move also for your body. But hey, that's no big deal because I love this and that and this and that. And that's it. Nothing. No body fat consciousness, etc. That's really one way. If you want to think about the prevention aspect of things, that's one aspect of that. Also in the firm community, and this always comes up, and I used to like poo-poo it a little bit, but the more I'm in working in this, I think that it's absolutely true. That we reinforce this value, unfortunately, especially with the Dukhan. I think that if we were all to just imagine what the firm community would be like if we did not have the pressure for Shidduchim, I think we would be radically different. Radically, radically, radically different. And unfortunately, size and shape is for some reason considered, it's mind-boggling to me because, you know, we have laws of tznias. I mean, the whole point is to teach that, you know, the externals are not the most important, you know. And we have gone, unfortunately, to the opposite extreme. It's worse than, unfortunately, than in the secular world. That's the reports that I get. So we really have to think about that. Yes?
You know, I don't know how I came across this information, but it seems to me that when a girl is going to get married, they want that girl to have the most sexual underwear. Like, you know, it's just like all these gorgeous brassieres and like seductive underwear, and it's just these girls are making a crime.
I don't understand.
They just think that the guy has to be sexually satisfied and he has to lust for her. And I mean, what is the girl thinking? I mean, she's just a body.
Yeah, it's a slightly different.
I mean, look, I'm a biologist. I've never
came across
anything like that.
Right. I hear you totally, and that's sort of connected to what we're talking about. But this is, sorry? It's more of a body image attitude toward women, et cetera, et cetera. But.
Which all affects. All has an effect. The part that I really want us to think about, really, is to think about the values that we perpetrate. If we see something going on in our community, you know, it's really scary to be the first parent to say, okay, you know, my daughter is going to be healthily, going to be have a healthy figure, and I care about her health more than I care about, you know, what the shadchanim say. That's hard. We have to put our children's welfare before being skinny. It sounds ridiculous, but it's not.
It does not sound ridiculous. I'm sorry, it does not sound ridiculous.
Right.
I was in the Shidduch system for 8 years before I met my husband on Formfood.com, which I highly advocate for. It's a wonderful site. And I'm telling you, as a dietitian and also as a firm person, 100% what you're saying is true, and I hope wish more people would say it. And I know an actress who's a Bala Subramanian, but she has never been more objectified in her life than she is in the firm community.
Yep, right.
An actress. Okay.
Yep. The firm community is unfortunately, because I think whatever we do to an extreme.
Right.
Whatever values we integrate to an extreme. We don't do anything in half measures. So we are extremely, extremely focused on body, unfortunately. And people really suffer. I know one lady once called me up and said that she had kids that were struggling with whether or not they wanted to stay from, because they felt like they had heavier sized bodies. They weren't getting shidduchim. They didn't feel like being alone for the rest of their life. If this is what Frumkite perpetuates, they may as well just go leave Frumkite and go find some place where they'll be more accepted. And you know what? They will be more accepted.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we have to realize we are perpetuating this. Yeah.
I think a lot of it is also that when the Shachana makes the center girl, it presents it to the backwards, especially the tribe that she was playing to be the tribe of inner. And I think from there, you start doing the opposite. I think it makes a huge difference. If you start going through the inside, and the guy's like, okay, what does she look like? Well, you say she has great needs, she's outgoing, she's this, she's that, and then get her look. I think if you do it backwards,
right. The other thing I think we need to be conscious of, and I think this is also very integrated, and it's something that we really need to think about, and I have, I think, an article on there in the folder, but what do you say when you first meet somebody?
Where are you from?
Looks so good. Right? That's what we say. You look so good. If I ate an apple instead of a piece of cake, can I say that I was so good? Oh, I had an apple. I didn't have a piece of cake. I'm so good. Or, it's Yontif, and I just came back, right? And it's like, oh, you know, my hips, or whatever. I mean, the emphasis, and it's not only, I'm not saying that we can't, you know, tell our daughter that she's beautiful. I'm not saying that looks are not an important aspect of life. I'm saying if it's an obsession, if it's a consistent focus, which it is in our community, we are going to be in trouble. The message we are giving the kids is, you want to be accepted? You want someone to have a big smile on their face when they see you, and they're so happy to see you? Look good.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Or else they'll say nothing. Or else
the answer is, of course you'll say I look good with my mother.
Well, that's a different, that's a whole dynamic issue. But that's a different thing.
One answer to that is that Gila Madison writes about Sneha's wonderful books. Says you should call a girl a beautiful neshama. You're a beautiful neshama, you know? And then you concentrate on the spiritual rather than just the physical.
Right. I'm not saying to ignore the physical. A kid has to know that their parents think that they're beautiful if they do. But I am saying that we have to not only, also just in general modeling. I will walk into a school, a Balance and Eating Disorders workshop, and they'll have cake and cookies out, and they'll say, like, isn't that ironic? You have cake and cookies out.
Well,
you know, I should have had an apple. You know what I'm saying? Like, and it takes forever to people get the message that you've got to stop making these things good and bad. Fat and thin, right and wrong, black and white. Not the truth. It's not humanity. And we are, sorry, one second please. And we are, in that way, giving over a certain set of values to our kids. And they're getting it at younger. I was seeing an interview of a kid who was about 6 years old who talked about how her mother, she was anorexic. She was anorexic to the point that she even, like, just would eat paper to stop her appetite. And Q-tip heads. And she said that she would come to the table. Now, this was obviously a vulnerable child, right? But she would come to the table, sensitive kid, and the mother would say, she doesn't have to be too sensitive for this, but she was somewhat sensitive. The mother would say, oh, I'm so fat, I have to go on a diet. Now, how many times do we say that around people?
My mother never said that to me, ever. Never.
Good. But most people...
No, never by herself. Right.
Even if you're talking about yourself, you are reinforcing the value of being ashamed of the way your body looks, of needing to control the way your body looks, etc., etc., etc. She said, I thought if my mommy had to go on a diet. Now, I'm telling you now, all the convincing in the world wouldn't have changed her mind. She knows that her mommy doesn't like her body. We once had a kid also that was in... Oh my God, I am so running late. There was a kid in one of our programs who raised his hand and said that his father, this is extreme, but it happened. The father told the mother, they were supposed to go to the beach for vacation, and the father said to the mother, not until you lose 20 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And the kid heard this. Now, we don't all go to that extreme, but we need to think about the subtleties of the messages that we are giving over. Yes?
I was dealing with a teenager girl, and if you're going around and questioning the best place, you can have to talk to the Dr. Neville told me that it was a similar factor, and the best place there is a question of tax protection which people look around TV. This is the best place around. I think people should know this. The name is Jim Irish. The name of the doctor is Dr. Neville Golden. He's extremely compassionate, strong, and I'll give you his number if you want. The number is 516.
The number is in there, by the way. I gave out a whole listing of doctors.
I've been through many of them. 516-465-3270. They accept most insurances.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to leave. Now we have about 10 minutes, a little bit less. I'm going to leave some time for questions, if anybody has, or comments.
I'm very much health food and everything else. My ex doesn't have an eating disorder, and I feel that my understanding of food is healthy, but I just want to make sure that it is. Like, when other people, a friend of mine, were against health food, I always made sure that when the kids went to school that they had something that was like part of it. It wasn't like really healthy, it wasn't really unhealthy, it had some sugar in it so that they felt somewhat normal, you know, and I always showed that there was slack somewhere. Like birthday parties, we always had cake, we always had slack left over. I feel that my kids somewhat do borderline on or eating disorder, they're teenagers, but I'm hoping, I don't know if I'm role modeling, I'm always conscious of my weight and I don't like my body. So I'm just wondering.
Do they pick up on it?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's not possible to hide it. It's not a mother. You could try to protect. Certainly, if I'm a teacher and I walk into the classroom, right, I don't have to say, oh, it was Sukkot, and you know, my hips are so bad. I don't have to say that. I can protect them from that. But on some level, when your kids who live with you, your students are around you all the time, they do pick up on it. And what you need to do then is work on yourself.
If I'm going to win, an eating support group right now, and I'm trying to learn to eat healthy meat and trying to be balanced.
Yes, but it's not about the food.
I'm missing something there.
It's not about the food. If somebody is feeling uncomfortable in their own body and in their own skin, if feeling a lot of need to control their food, it's an emotional issue. And what needs to be treated, it needs to be... It's a lot of things. It's a lot of things, but it's much more a psychological issue. So that manipulating the food might, you know, temporarily alleviate some symptomology, but usually it just exasperates the struggle.
With the psychological aspect.
Yeah, with an expert.
Yeah, most people treat eating disorders, they're not dietitians, they're social workers and psychologists. That's what they think.
Right.
And the nutritionist that tries to deal with eating disorders and the
depends on the eating disorder. It depends on the severity of the eating disorder. But even the nutritionist should have training in eating disorders in terms of the psychological pieces of it, because it's a whole different ballgame. Whole different ballgame.
Well, I just want to say that my daughter, she was 12 when she came to me, and she was very concerned about her weight. She looked getting a little chubby, so she was an athlete to do, and I told her, you know, give her the time, because she's puberty and whatever, see what happens after that. But she's still a little bit heavy, and she asked me, and I told her, and I showed her, I really taught her, which was, like you say, to gain control over that piece and to empower her, because it's not about the food. So I showed her how to be labeled, and I showed her what a portion would look like. I tried to teach her what you mentioned before about staying in touch with when her body felt full, and I said, if you're still hungry, you know, after 20 minutes, you know, then we'll get to pull something else.
I would call it external restriction. I would still call that external restriction. In other words, what we try to teach, and I don't know why I missed out this part, is for them to use their hunger signals and their satiety signals as a cue for how much they need to eat. There was no quote-unquote portion.
Right.
You just learn how your body needs to process food. How, you know, eventually you learn through trial and error. This is usually when people do this in the beginning, if there's somebody who's been on 10 diets before this, in the beginning they will eat only candy. Because it's getting out of that prison feeling. But eventually they'll learn to tune into their body and to learn to eat what their body needs with mindfulness, recognizing that your body needs nutrition. You know, and if most of the time you're eating sugar and cakes, you might want to look at that and say, you know, I have no problem with you eating sugar cakes, but I need to incorporate some more food.
Well,
as opposed to take away.
Different times for girls anyway, if it's different times in the month, different times in your life, right. Your body also sends a signal to these people, so it means, you know, whatever.
Absolutely.
It means, so.
Absolutely. Look, we don't, you know, count how many times we're allowed to go to the bathroom. Right? Hunger is a basic drive. It's a basic drive. Somebody had a hand over here? Go ahead. Mm-hmm. It's not uncommon because it's really the flip side of the same coin. Is she working with the eating disorder therapist? So she's probably, well, I don't know who she's going to, but if she's working with an effective eating disorder therapist, then there'll probably a stage that she's going to go through and she'll get through it. But I don't know who she's working with. I don't know what's going on. People, I would need to speak to you personally, but I did give out a number, 718-431-9501. That's Relief. And they have an eating disorders segment on there. And you can call to get referrals specifically. And also, my number is in the folder if you want to call me at work. Okay? Somebody in the corner? Yes. Come on, the room or in general?
In general, what we have to admit is that she had those feelings, but not the
emotions. So what do you think it might be some of the
answers? I think it's a unique person who was in the relationship. He talked about diet, he talked about his weight, but it wasn't exceptionally, it wasn't the why. The why is much stronger. That's what I think, but I want to be able to answer.
Well, I'll tell you what I think. I think there are a couple of reasons. First of all, like we see, I think there are a couple of reasons. I'll focus specifically on the sperm community, but also just in general, we see that, let's say, physical diseases like diabetes, for instance, they're also filtering down to lower and lower ages, right? There's a lot of, the kids are more frail. Why is that? Because you have a parent at one level with a certain ability to process the sugar. Hi. Okay. We're just finishing up.
Okay, don't leave it like that. I just want to thank everyone for coming. Remind you to please fill out the evaluation form. Let me know that both now and after the keynote session, there will be cakes available of all the programs. And thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I'm sure it was wonderful.
So I think that, so let's say for instance diabetes, we're eating, we're in an environment that's much more toxic, we all know that. We have much more processed foods. That has a physical influence on our bodies. So that we're not so surprised that we're seeing diabetes. It's upsetting and it's shocking, but the kids are going to have a weaker constitution if they're coming from a parent who has a semi-weak constitution. So it's understandable. So the same thing on some level. If we have families that are falling apart more now than they were 30 years ago, say, more chaos, more depression, more anxiety, et cetera, then it's understandable that the children of those people will even have more vulnerability toward those specific disorders. That's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is that it's true. We unfortunately are a very black and white society. I think that the whole at-risk youth thing is a symptom of that. I'll tell you that a lot of people with eating disorders feel a lot of spiritual emptiness.
That's right.
A lot of spiritual emptiness. So we're doing something in the firm community where we're practicing, but we don't understand the meaning by how what we're doing. We don't have a connection to it through beauty. We have more connection to it through obligation and through rote. And that creates a very, very big split between the practice and the meaning, and in that emptiness comes the obsession. And that's true for eating disorders, that's true for drug addictions, that's true for any kind of at-risk behavior. It's an emptiness that they're looking to fill. We need to look at that also. But that's also very, very, you know, there's a lot of inconsistency between what people practice and what they preach. A lot of inconsistency, but also a lot of lack of understanding. They themselves don't have an understanding for why they're doing things, so there's no spiritual sustenance. Okay? And that's a very, very common thing also. And I think as that gets bigger, so do the eating disorders, and so do all these other issues in the film community. Because if you notice, like, let's say you go to addiction programs, all of them will be 12-step models. There are a few eating disorder ones, but all of them, they find that spirituality has a huge part to do with it.